Dear brothers and sisters, this morning the sermon preacher has spoken with such charming humor about my speaking English and understanding English, that I am stimulated for a risk to tell you a story about my learning English in not with manuscript. Some years ago, when I gave my first lecture in English in Chicago, I was very nervous, and learned my lecture in order to deliver it like a parrot. But I didn't understand my own words. Yes. When people laugh, I thought, in this moment you are telling a joke. And after the lecture, a gentleman came to me and said, I thought German language would be a very difficult language, but I understood at least two sentences. I hope that you understand also at almost two sentences. Reformation ethics teaches us in the strict sense not what we are obliged to do, but what we are permitted to do. It surveys the broad expanse of freedom. If the theme of ethics is such, is thus the freedom of a Christian man, it is important that we come first of all to a new understanding of what this freedom is. For men of our day to understand it, however, it is necessary that we learn to see it not as something to which we are condemned, a la Sartre, but as a gift, a new possibility of existence. For the fear of freedom from which we suffer today derives essentially from the fact that we no longer truly exist, we merely vegetate, standing no longer in an eternal foundations. We experience a call to freedom as a threat of exposure. We fear the damning testimony that might reveal our true condition. For if I am to live as a free man, this means in the first place that I will have to be myself. I will have to become a subject. If I am not that, then I am not free at all. I am merely an object, the nameless component of whatever is operating through me, the instrument of an alien will, be it even the will of God. Either that, or I am but the hapless victim of my own anxieties and longings. In either case, it is appeal to my freedom which compels me to admit the void within. There is simply nothing left in me to be free, for in default of my true existence, I simply vegetate. This is a point at which freedom ceases to be a desired ideal and becomes instead a wearisome burden. This is especially clear, for example, in the case of leisure, the temporal form of freedom. Modern society seems to be moving with all deliberate speed in the direction of the shortest possible work week and the maximum possible free time. Here too it is apparent that to the degree that man has lost his existence, his leisure is nothing but one vast expanse of emptiness or boredom. Free time can actually become a burden which oppresses rather than an opportunity for relaxation and collected in the sense of pulling oneself together. But this can happen only if there is some prior center of existence upon which the centripetal movements can converge. If that center has been lost, there is nothing left to do the pulling. Instead, the movement becomes wholly centrifugal, and I find myself running off in all directions. I literally go to pieces. If such diversion is anything more than an incident on the way to renewal, if disintegration proves to be the prevailing pattern of my life, it can only magnify the void within and even lead to neurosis. This is why we must respect the honesty of Sartre's opinion that we are condemned to freedom. What is gift and fulfillment for the existing individual is torture and shame for him who no longer truly exists. The call to freedom becomes good news only when our existence has been given a new foundation and so is enabled to be free. Now it is a law of God's dealing with us that the gift always precedes the task. The indicative that posits the new creature comes before the imperative appeal to become new beings ever reaches us. What this means concretely is that something else, something quite different, happens first before we are commanded to love. God first discloses himself to us as a lovable object, an objectum amabile, to use a neat term of the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. Our love for God is kindled only as God bears his heart to us, thereby himself becoming an object that can be loved. It is his act of love that makes mind come alive as a fount of spontaneous action, something that can do its own loving. Love need not, it cannot be initiated by legal injunction. On the contrary, my love is a matter of response. Only when I am myself loved do I feel compelled to love in return. I react in freedom to the divine love which has first been bestowed upon me. And this is the beginning of my new existence, which is now, but only now and not before, susceptible of being free. For the person who does not yet exist as a person, who has not thus been liberated to love, is really asking too much that he be free. He must instead flee freedom. For him, freedom becomes law, a grievous burden weighing heavily upon him. For the existing individual, on the contrary, freedom is not law, but gift. The gift which enables him to be himself and starts him on the way to becoming what he was intended to be. For this reason alone, evangelical ethics cannot possibly be casuistic. For its purpose is not to baby men or lead them around by the nose, but to open to them the broad reaches of freedom. Freedom, however, means more than simply a choice between two given alternatives. The call to be free means rather that it is me myself who must discover and define the alternatives in the first place. The decision I face is more fundamental than that of simply choosing between one opinion labeled obedience and another labeled disobedience. I must first find out for myself, even in the course of my choosing and deciding, just what obedience actually entails, just what the will of God actually is in the particular situation. It is relatively easy for me to decide in favor of obedience to God. It is relatively easy to resolve to live according to his will. Complications arise, however, when I am confronted with the concrete realities of a specific situation. For then I must know concretely what it is God wants of me here and now. And to discover that requires something more than merely acts of the will. After all, I have many such resolutions behind me already, following upon my basic decision to do God's will. But what precisely is God's will for me now in this situation, that is a question. It is at this point that the call to obedience brings out beyond the sphere of the will alone and penetrates the sphere of the mind, nous, intellectus. For what is required now is that I come to understand this situation in which I find myself. I must analyze it and interpret it. I must inquire as to what values are really at stake and perhaps in conflict, and how I am to assess them. In other words, I am summoned now to obedience as an intellectual task. It is not as if I were confronted merely with a ready-made alternative to obey or not to obey. On the contrary, given my acknowledged willingness to obey, I must now do some hard and responsible thinking in order to discover the concrete shape of the either-or with which I am actually confronted. This is, to be sure, not a purely intellectual exercise. The intellect alone might come up with a host of subtle and convincing arguments in favor of my following, for example, the line of least resistance. Selecting the either-or must be congenial to myself. Indeed, this is how the act of disobedience can actually move from the level of the will to the level of the mind. For even my thinking can involve disobedience. It can be nothing more than the spokesman for my own self-interest. This is while all ethical decision already begins within the sphere of reflection, of reason itself. Certainly, it is a mark of the adult that he establishes the authentic alternatives for himself. His mind is engaged, not just his will. Ethical decision is not something that comes after a process of neutral, decision-free, purely theoretical reflection. On the contrary, it is part and parcel of all such reflection from the very beginning. Casuistry, of course, looks at all of this quite differently. A casuistically oriented ethics has, as it were, a kind of prefabricated picture of what is required in any given situation. In essence, the decisions have all been made in advance. Such prefabricated decisions, of course, remove from men the necessity of deciding for themselves. Casuistry of this kind always follows a consistent and necessary pattern of development. Whatever the particular rule or regulation, it must always be progressively refined. And however small the area allotted to personal decision, it must be progressively reduced until it is eliminated entirely. In short, the net of norms must always be rewoven in a smaller gauge. A classic example of such development is, of course, the Talmud, where norms become progressively detailed until every step of the way is prescribed. I can perhaps illustrate what I mean by citing an amusing example for a recent article. It aptly demonstrates well this process whereby the mesh in casuistry's net of norms is made increasingly fine. In the large cities of Italy, says the article, kissing in public has long been prohibited. In 1936, however, the law was amended to allow for a farewell kiss at railroad stations, bus stops, and taxi stands. Meanwhile, fines were prescribed for such kisses, as were obviously not in the nature of a farewell. Thus, it was decided, and here is where the smaller gauge enters the picture, that to qualify as a genuine farewell, one had to be embarking upon a journey which would involve a separation of no less than 12 hours. This was a quote. Now, I can well imagine that casuistry is built in tendency toward ever more detailed refinement would not be content to stop there. The next step would probably be to define separation in terms of distance as well as duration. Then there would have to be still further refinements. Perhaps the purpose of the separation would have to be taken into account in determining the legitimacy of the kiss. The occasion, for example, would have to be something out of the ordinary, some moving experience that could evoke emotions of sadness or joy. Criminal psychologists would additionally be required to establish whether the intensity of the kiss, be it said or Joyce, was truly commensurate with the ostensible occasion. Even the occasions themselves, death, illness, a sudden windfall, and so on, would probably have to be stipulated in casuistic detail. Granted, the picture which I have portrayed here is overdrawn. But even an obvious caricature can at times be highly suggestive. In the case of casuistry, ethical obedience does not require an involvement of the mind. Casuistry does not ask whether the reason too is operating in a responsible way, whether it is struggling to discover what concretely is to be done. On the contrary, in casuistry, ethical obedience is restricted solely to the deed whereby I fulfill a prescribed ought. Under these circumstances, the one who acts is in a sense only half a man, to adapt a phrase from Luther, de medium cordis, half a heart. That part of a man which thinks is excluded from the decision-making process. It has delegated its responsibility to an alien agency whose casuistic rules it accepts as binding authority sign unseen. Only that part of man which acts the performance of overt deeds is still admitted to the sphere where decisions are made. Thus, the whole broad range of possibilities is no longer open. The area of decision has been reduced to the point where only one choice remains, either to accept the casuistic rules and regulations as bindings or to reject them altogether. Man's capacity to be a self, to be a subject in his own right, is correspondingly reduced. For to be a self means that a man's mind too must be engaged in ethical decision. That this requirement of total engagement is fully in line with the New Testament thought is borne out, it seems to me, in numerous contexts. The ethical directives of Jesus and the apostles are framed dialectically. They make no attempt to say precisely what is to be done. Instead, they set up a framework of decision within which a choice must be made between antithetical alternatives. Two instances come readily to mind. First, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's, Matthew 22. Here it is apparent that the whole matter of decision is still left open. Nothing has been decided in advance. The clever question of the Pharisees, to which Jesus was giving answer, was formulated, of course, in such a way as to pin Jesus down to a specifically casuistic situation. Had he denied Caesar the right to collect, taxes, declaring in a casuistically unequivocal way, "You shall never pay any taxes whatsoever to Caesar," they would have made him out to be an enemy of the state. Conversely, had he affirmed the right of the pagan emperor to impose taxes upon God's people, they would have accused him of unfaithfulness to the God of Israel. Thus, the question of the Pharisees clearly subscribes to the fundamental principle of casuistry. It assumes that the only option is to choose within an existing framework of alternatives, and this Jesus refuses to accept. His answer is obviously more than merely a tactical maneuver designed to save his own skin. Jesus' statement is rather a profound affirmation of the openness of decision. The either-or itself has not yet been properly framed. The decision is still wide open. The mind, if you will, must be engaged. Second, we must obey God rather than man. Acts 5. The openness of the decision called for in this statement is perfectly apparent in that the situation within which the indicated choice must ultimately be made has not been prescribed in advance. Individuals will differ in their judgment as to whether that situation has actually materialized. One person will think, for example, that under the pressures of an ideological tyranny, he can effect some sort of compromise. The time to stand up for my faith has not yet arrived. I will do that later, when the issue is more clear out and the conflict sufficiently out in the open to make martyrdom worthwhile. I will not let my witness be stilled prematurely. In the name of God, I will not. Another person, however, will feel that he must make his position unmistakably clear from the outset. I will stand up for my faith at the first and slightest provocation. The mind is thus engaged, ethically engaged, already in the very matter of assessing the particular situation. Accordingly, it is altogether impossible to anticipate in advance and analyze every conceivable situation in order to arrive at a casuistically determined set of alternatives which would apply under whatever circumstances may eventually obtain. The concrete action to be taken must always remain an open question. Indeed, this is why it will always be possible for two Christians to act quite differently in any given situation. While this doubtless means a certain relativizing of the ethical deed, or better, of the concrete shape of ethical obedience, this relativizing too has its basis in the Reformation understanding of justification. According to the evangelical view, the decisions that really count are not determined by the things we do. On this core, Augustine's dictum stands firm: love and do what you want, diligere et fac quod vis. The decisions that really count are made rather in terms of how we relate to God. They involve, again in Augustine's terminology, the question whether we love him and trust him. One might say that the real decision comes at the point of the plus or minus sign that precedes the brackets in which my several deeds and accomplishments are totaled up. The addenda within these brackets may vary considerably without altering in the least the character of that preceding sign. Now, the objection could perhaps be raised that where the mind is engaged in the decision-making process, risk is correspondingly diminished. After all, so runs the argument, it is then reason which does the choosing. And when reason sets up to discover an indicated action, that is hopefully not a matter of venture, but of insight. Reason strives to supplant uncertainty with well-grounded objectivity. If we are to respond to this objection at all, it is necessary to inquire first concerning the ground of reason itself. To put the question more precisely, does not rational existence as such rest upon the base of a prior act of decision, and in this way indeed have something to do with a decision inherent in faith? To be sure, faith cannot alter the facts established by reason, but it definitely can and does affect a man's relationship to reason. Faith has something to say about whether a man can or cannot have a rational existence. Objectivity, the attitude that accords with reason and with the things that fall within its purview, is itself a human stance, and hence the product of those formative powers which fashion all human behavior. Since faith is one of these powers, we can only conclude that objectivity indeed has something to do with the emancipation, with the redemption in which faith believes. Since faith is one of these powers, we can only conclude that objectivity indeed has something to do with the emancipation, with the redemption in which faith believes. Faith and objectivity do not necessarily represent distinct dimensions of human behavior. Indeed, they converge at the point where the believer is freed to be objective. That this is in fact the case becomes clear at the moment when we consider wherein this emancipation for rationality consists. It consists in the fact that reason is protected over against the norms above, over against heteronomy, and over against the emotions below, and so is helped, as it were, to stand on its own feet. Without this protection, as we well know from our own daily experience, reason is always in danger of being ruled by the emotions, by hope and by fear. Thy wish was, Father, hurry to that thought. Quotation, Shakespeare, Henry IV. Thus Shakespeare expressed one of the perils to which reason is exposed. The opposite peril is that posed by fear. Whatever I fear just cannot be. A prominent surgeon, for example, may fail to discover his own cancer because he so desperately fears the disease. Medical reason is simply not objective when it comes to the matter of the doctor's own health. Indeed, it may actually mislead him, because the medical reason is so highly developed, it can provide him with all kinds of sophisticated arguments for interpreting the slides of his own tumor tissue, for example, in terms of something other than what they really show. This is why my objectivity, my respect for the facts is not to be trusted, precisely because I am not disinterested. On the contrary, I am very much interested and always on the lookout for rational grounds on which to justify my assertion that what I hope for really is, and that what I am afraid of really is not. Luther must have had this in mind when he spoke of reason as the devil's whore. It can be bought for a price. Objectivity results then only as man is emancipated from fear and from hope. That is, he must first be released from what he fears into the custody of him who saves from the dread of this world. He must first be released from what he hopes into the custody of him who insists on being the sole object of man's hope. Only release from such constraints and bondage can make man truly unconstrained and unfettered, which is to say, truly objective. Since this fundamental change is dependent upon a venture of man's reason, in which reason is given a new foundation, it is clear that the risk inherent in all choice is not barred from the sphere of reason, but has its place there as well. Indeed, wherever reason is not controlled by authentic existence, it can itself become a tyrant. It can become the object of a rational superstition, and hence a conduit to heteronomy and a roadblock to man's coming of age. According to the Reformation understanding, then, we are not handed to a clear and detailed set of norms by which to operate. But neither are we left totally bereft of all guidance, obliged to determine everything for ourselves on the basis of our own inner disposition. Either of these views would be a misconception. I can perhaps clarify what I mean by citing a simple analogy. The Bible does not provide me with a detailed roadmap on which every leg of my journey is plainly marked in advance. I am not told at every turn which way I should go, how I should decide, for example, in questions relating to birth control, abortion, capital punishment, and the conflict between truth and love. If all such decisions came to me ready-made, I would simply be implementing a will other than my own. I would be subject to heteronomy. Even though I am not supplied with such prefabricated decisions, however, I do not stand alone, totally at a loss for direction. wherein then does my guidance consist? It is as if I had been handed a compass and then turned loose to find my own way. The compass needle always points in the same direction. It points toward the command of love for God and neighbor. This is the direction in which I must go, and at very juncture I must take my bearings once again to see if I am still headed in the right direction. The route itself, however, is something I must find for myself. In conclusion, I need to allow humor to speak and to clarify what I have said by means of a picture. In our German bathrooms, there are two kinds of showers. The one kind of shower hangs from the ceiling. You have to place yourself under it. The other kind you take in your hand and spray the water on the desired parts of the body. Now let us assume that ice-cold water came from both showers, so that we can clarify by both kinds the different relationship of ethics to norms. The shower that hangs from the ceiling represents casuistry, moral theology. Here you only have to decide if you have the guts to jump under the cold shower. The question with which I am confronted is reduced to a simple yes or no, ready or not ready. That is a very simple given alternative. If I choose to get under, then the shower takes care of everything else by itself. I only need to stand still, like in casuistry. The hand shower, however, and indeed that is now the Protestant one, the hand shower is different. Here I have to decide anew at every moment against which part of the body I will direct it. Thank you.
I think for a hearing you may have to come up to the.
Ja, einfach verstanden. Das Verhältnis deiner theologischen Untersuchung von Ethik und Glaube in der existenziellen Situation und der Situationsethik von Joseph Pletcher. Danach wird gefragt.
Ja. Das ist in der Tat die zentrale Frage.
This indeed is the central question.
Und ich habe mich absichtlich oft sehr unvorsichtig ausgedrückt, um diese Frage zu provozieren.
And I have purposely expressed myself rather unguardedly in order to provocate that question.
Die, Also um es zunächst allgemein zu sagen, ich stimme gar nicht mit Pletcher überein.
To make a general statement at the beginning, I don't at all agree with Joseph Pletcher.
Ich habe seinerzeit in Houston mich auch ein bisschen mit ihm herumgeschlagen, was wegen seiner charmanten Art gar nicht so leicht ist.
1968 I met this charming man in Houston and I have talked with him about this question and indeed it was not very easy to talk with him about it because he has so great charm.
Der Grundgedanke von Fletcher ist ja, dass wenn der Mensch liebt, er die Gebote Gottes erfüllt.
The basic thought of Joseph Fletcher is that if man loves, he will fulfill the laws of God.
Dieses Motiv legitimiert jede Art von Tun, die daraus folgen mag.
This motive of love legitimates any way of action which follows out of this motive.
Es wäre also theoretisch im, aufgrund der Fletcherschen Konzeption möglich, dass man Euthanasie betreibt oder die Abtreibung großzügig und liberal handhabt.
Therefore, it might be conceivable, for example, to condone euthanasia and to perform and to act in the situation of abortion rather liberally.
Mit anderen Worten, er meint, dass abgesehen von dem Liebesgebot es überhaupt keine präzisen Willensäußerungen Gottes gibt.
In other words, he implies that apart from the love to from the command to love, there are no precise directives as to how I am act within the confines of this command at all.
Was ich für bedenklich halte, ist hierbei, dass die Liebe zu einem Prinzip gemacht wird.
I consider it rather ponderable that love is made a principle in this context.
Und zwar, genauer gesagt, ein Indifferenzprinzip.
And to be a little bit more precise, a principle of indifference.
Schauen wir nun einmal das Bibel, das neutestamentliche Liebesgebot an, erkennen wir ein völlig anderes Verständnis von Liebe.
But if we now look at the New Testament understanding of love, we find a very different kind of understanding.
Hier ist die Liebe jedenfalls kein Prinzip.
Love certainly here is not a principle.
Sondern sie ist durch Gott bestimmt, der uns geliebt hat.
But rather, love here is determined by God, who has loved us first.
Und unsere Liebe ist dadurch charakterisiert, dass sie Reaktion auf diese Liebe Gottes ist.
And our love is therefore determined as the kind of love which is a reaction to God's love towards us.
Deswegen bedeutet Gott zu lieben, in Konformitas mit ihm zu sein.
And for that reason, to love God implies being conform with him.
Das heißt aber dann, dass das, was wir aus dem Motiv der Liebe tun, dem Willen Gottes nicht widersprechen kann.
But this implies then further that that which we do out of the command to love, we certainly do not contrary to God's will.
Ich habe also gegenüber Fletcher das Bedenken, dass sein Gedanke der Liebe nicht mehr qualifiziert ist durch den Autor der Liebe Gottes.
I therefore ask of Joseph Fletcher the question, I have inhibitions to accept his understanding of love insofar as it is no longer legitimated by the author of all love, namely God.
Und weil er ein Prinzip daraus gemacht hat, kann er im Grunde alles mit Hilfe dieses Prinzips legitimieren.
And since he has made a principle out of love, it is possible to legitimate by this love anything.
Es ist gleichsam der säkularisierte christliche Liebesgedanke.
Joseph Fletcher's thought of love is, so to say, the secularized notion of love.
Säkularisiert deshalb, weil der Ursprung der Liebe vergessen worden ist.
I say secularization because the origin of the concept of love has been lost.
In mancher Hinsicht hat Paulus dieses vom Fletcher gestellte Problem schon behandelt.
In some way Paul has already treated this problem which is posed to us by Joseph Fletcher's position.
In Römer 6 und auch in 1. Korinther 6 und 1. Korinther 10.
In Romans 6 and also in 1. Corinthians 6 and 10
kommt er ja auf die Frage zu sprechen, ob für den, der sich durch Gott gerechtfertigt weiß, alles Tun indifferent wird.
In these passages Paul addresses the question whether he who is loved by God will become altogether indifferent to anything else that he confronts.
Im Korintherbrief, 1. Korintherbrief, kann er sagen, dass mir in der Tat alles erlaubt ist.
In 1. Corinthians he will say, indeed, everything has been permitted for me to do.
Ich kann zum Beispiel Götzenopferfleisch essen.
For example, I can eat meat offered to idols.
Warum nicht?
Why not?
Trotzdem sagt er, es gibt eine Grenze in der Art, wie ich diese Freiheit in Anspruch nehmen darf.
But nevertheless, Paul says that there is a limitation to the way in which I use this freedom that has been given to me.
Denn es kann ja zum Beispiel sein, dass ein christlicher Bruder da ist, der den Götzenglauben noch nicht überwunden hat.
For example, he can say that there may be a Christian brother among those to whom I'm speaking who does not have, who has not overcome this fetish of belief in idols.
Und wenn er noch unter diesem Banne steht, bedeutet das Essen des Götzenopferfleisches eine Absage an Christus.
And if he is still charmed by this fetish, then it can imply that if he, then he can be led to believe that if he eats meat offered to idols, he will do wrong.
Dann verführe ich ihn also dazu.
And if I exhort him to be free, I tempt him to do something which he considers to be wrong.
Hier gibt Paulus also zu verstehen, dass der Glaube mich zwar frei macht.
Here Paul tells us that indeed faith frees us,
genauso wie die Liebe mich frei macht,
just as love frees us also,
dass diese Freiheit aber nicht bindungslos ist und nicht indifferent wird.
But Paul tells us that this freedom does not loose us of all bonds and does not make us altogether indifferent,
sondern ständig fragen muss, inwieweit diese Freiheit nun in Konformität mit dem Willen Gottes gebraucht wird.
This freedom rather implies that we always constantly have to ask ourselves, how can we act in conformity with God's will?
Und ebenso muss sie fragen, was ich dem Nächsten schuldig bin.
And similarly, this love must also ask, what do I owe to my neighbor?
Und hier tritt noch einmal eine neue Einschränkung meiner Freiheit ein.
And here we are confronted with a second, a new kind of limitation of my freedom.
Denn wer der Nächste ist und wen ich für meinen Nächsten halte, das liegt nicht in meiner Verfügung.
For who then this neighbor may be is not at all at the discretion of my freedom.
Ich könnte ja da etwa vom Gedanken ausgehen, ein Nächster ist für mich nur der, der mir sympathisch ist.
For example, I could be led by the thought that he is my neighbor who, whom I like most.
Oder der meine Interessen vertritt.
Or he is my neighbor who has the same interests as I do.
Paulus aber definiert hier den Nächsten wieder in ganz bestimmter Weise.
But rather, Paul defines my neighbor in a very definite way.
Er sagt, das ist der, für den Christus gestorben ist.
Paul says, my neighbor is he for whom Christ has died.
Der einen unendlichen Wert hat, weil er teuer erkauft ist.
He is my neighbor who has indefinite value because he has been bought at a dear price.
Ich kann also nicht aufgrund meiner Kriterien bestimmen, wer mein Nächster sein soll.
Therefore it is impossible for me to decide who is my neighbor on the basis of my own criteria.
Hier wird wieder sichtbar, wie die Liebe kein Prinzip ist.
Here again we see that love is not a principle,
sondern wie sie auf den weist, der mich liebt und der Liebe von mir fordert.
But rather that love points to him who has loved me and who asks me to love him back.
Und deshalb gewinnen die Gebote Gottes hier durchaus oder behalten die Gebote Gottes durchaus ihre Bedeutung.
And for that reason the commandments of God maintain their significance by all means.
Sie sind nicht im Namen der Freiheit dispensiert.
They are not abandoned in the name of freedom.
Aber sie bekommen jetzt eine andere Stellung.
But rather they gain now a different meaning.
Sie sind nicht mehr das bestimmende Gesetz im Sinne von Luthers Theologie.
They are no longer the law which determines us in the sense of Luther's theology.
Sondern sie bilden nur, sie haben nur die Aufgabe, mich ständig zu erinnern daran, was durch die Liebe gefordert ist von mir.
These commands rather imply that I am constantly exhorted to determine by myself what I am to do.
Denn das ist das vielleicht das tiefste Problem der Ethik, dass ich mich zwar zum Willen Gottes entschließen kann.
This indeed is the deepest problem of ethics, that I can indeed tell myself that I will love God,
dass ich mir aber gar nicht klar mache, dass in manchen Bereichen meines Lebens dieser Wille Gottes nicht zum Zuge kommt.
But that I'm at the same time not at all certain in many, many areas of life how this love will actually become realized.
Man braucht nur an die Bergpredigt zu denken.
We have to think only of the Sermon on the Mount.
In der Bergpredigt will jemand am Altar seinen Gottesdienst tun.
In the Sermon on the Mount, somebody wants to worship God at the altar.
Aber er hat unbewältigte Probleme mit seinen Nächsten.
But he is burdened with unresolved problems over against his neighbor.
Und er merkt gar nicht, dass das ein Widerspruch ist.
And he doesn't at all realize that there is a contradiction in this.
Sodass er ein Heuchler wird.
So he becomes a hypocrite.
Heuchelei ist im Sinne des Neuen Testamentes nicht eine bewusste Verstellung des Menschen.
Hypocrisy is in the New Testament not a conscious act,
sondern Heuchelei ist ein objektiver Selbstwiderspruch.
But rather hypocrisy is an objective self-contradiction,
den man unter Umständen selber gar nicht bemerkt.
And sometimes one doesn't even realize this kind of deception.
Ich könnte das noch an Beispielen verdeutlichen, aber dann rede ich viel zu viel.
I could exemplify this further, but if I would do that, I would talk much too much.
Could you tell us how your understanding of being free as a Christian man led you to participate in the assassination attempt against Hitler?
Du möchtest bitte klarstellen, wie dein Verständnis der christlichen Freiheit dich mit in die Gruppe des 20. Juli geführt hat.
Es gab eine ganze Reihe von Männern im Dritten Reich.
There was a whole group of people in the Third Reich,
die eine gewisse Kritik an der bekennenden Kirche übten,
which criticized the confessing church.
Ich gehörte auch zu denen.
And I also belong to these.
Bonhoeffer sogar sehr betont.
Bonhoeffer criticized the confessing church very profoundly.
Deshalb kritisierten wir die bekennende Kirche, weil sie gegenüber Hitler im Wesentlichen nur den unmittelbar geistlichen Bereich.
We criticized the confessing church because it represented over against Hitler and his ideology only the realm of the immediacy of the spirit.
Also man wollte nicht, dass das Wort Gottes antastet oder gar die Augsburgische Konfession.
The confessing church merely wanted that Hitler and his people did not touch the word of God or the Augsburg Confession.
Das hätte er übrigens auch nie getan.
Hitler would probably have never done that anyway.
Weil er sie gar nicht kannte.
Because he didn't know these.
Man wollte die Freiheit des Gottesdienstes schützen.
The confessing church wanted to protect the freedom of worship.
Und allenfalls noch die christlichen Jugendgruppen.
And possibly the Christian youth groups.
Aber das Problem Hitler saß an einer ganz anderen Stelle.
But the problem of Hitler's regime lay at a very different place.
Hitler hat zum Beispiel in der Kulturpolitik furchtbare Dinge gemacht.
Hitler has done terrible things in the politics of culture.
Wenn man etwa daran denkt, dass er diese Rassenideologie in die Köpfe der Jugend pflanzte.
For example, if we think of his success in implanting the ideology of race discrimination in the heads of young people,
dass er sie zur Brutalität erziehen wollte,
that he was successful in educating young people towards violence and brutality,
dass er ferner die Minoritäten nicht nur unterdrückte, sondern ausrottete, wie die Juden und die Geisteskranken.
He not only suppressed, but rather attempted to exterminate minorities like Jews and mentally retarded.
Und an dieser Stelle entsteht die Frage, geht das die Kirche an?
And here the question arises, is this of relevance to the church?
Hier gab es innerhalb der bekennenden Kirche schmerzliche Auseinandersetzungen.
Here there were rather painful controversies within the confessing church.
Es gab Bischöfe, die dann etwa sagten, das ist Politik, was er mit den Juden macht. Das geht die Kirche nichts an. Wir haben nur für das Wort Gottes zu sorgen.
There were bishops within the church who said, this is merely politics. This is not of relevance to the church. This the politicians should resolve.
Dieses war eine völlig missverstandene Lehre der zwei Reiche.
But this was a completely misunderstood teaching of the two kingdoms.
Und weil die Lehre von den zwei Reichen speziell auf Luther zurückgeht, ist später dieses Missverständnis auch Luther zur Last gelegt worden.
And because this teaching of the two kingdoms goes back to Luther, later on, the problems that resulted out of this politic were also put to the feet of the confessing church.
Man hat diese Lehre insofern völlig missverstanden.
One misunderstood this teaching altogether.
Insofern, als man meinte, das Weltreich, das Reich zur Linken, ist im Luthertum seiner Eigengesetzlichkeit überlassen.
One has misunderstood it insofar as one thought that the kingdom to the left, the political kingdom, is surrendered to its own laws.
Und Hitler ist eine Figur des Reiches zur Linken und dort hat er seine Rechte.
And Hitler is the ruler of the kingdom to the left and he therefore is entrusted with the powers of that kingdom.
Das ist eine fürchterliche Hypothek, die für viele Menschen auf dem Luthertum liegt in Deutschland.
But this is a very heavy mortgage resting on the shoulders of many Christians in Germany, even today.
Deswegen habe ich versucht, etwa in meiner theologischen Ethik diese Lehre von den zwei Reichen neu zu interpretieren.
And for that reason I have attempted in my theological ethics to interpret anew this Lutheran teaching of the two kingdoms.
Und im Dritten Reich war das eine ganz unmittelbare Frage an uns, die noch gar nichts mit ethischen Reflexionen zu tun hatte.
And at the time of the Third Reich this was a question of great immediacy to us which was not at all resolved as yet.
Und die Frage lautete für uns damals so.
And the question that we were confronted with was this.
Haben wir nicht die Aufgabe, im Namen der Liebe, den Minoritäten Schutz zu verleihen?
The question was this. Don't we have the obligation to protect minorities in the name of Christian love?
Müssen wir nicht im Namen Jesu Christi die Ideologie, die diesem System zugrunde liegt, bekämpfen?
Don't we have in the name of Christ to fight against the ideology which is the foundation of this regime?
Das hat natürlich eine politische Seite dann.
This of course has a political aspect.
Und aus diesem Grunde kam es dazu, dass die Kirche auch mit den Männern des 20. Juli Fühlung hatte.
And for this reason, became apparent and increasingly a reality that the men of the confessing church began to have a relation to the group of the 20th of July which attempted to assassinate Hitler. In my understanding, the church could not by itself conduct a revolution. The reasons for this conviction on my part would lead too far. I cannot take time here to explain them. Nevertheless, the sermon of judgment, the preaching of judgment conducted by the Confessing Church, was in many instances parallel to what the assassination group of the 20th of July wanted to do.